As always, it's wonderful to be sitting together with you. And this morning I began our meditation with the chant, "I am alive." And that song asks the question, what is this aliveness I feel? Who is this aliveness I am? How is this aliveness I am? And I began with that because today we'll be reflecting together on the Torah reading, the Parsha Chayei Sarah. And even though it is, we would translate that as the life of Sarah, Sarah's lifetime, it begins with her death and details about her burial. There are more details about the burial than her actual dying, the negotiations over finding a place for her. And it ends with the death and the burial of Avraham. And in between these bookend burials, we have the promise of new life with Isaac and Rebekah's marriage. And so, this juxtaposition that begins with the words Chayei Sarah, Chayei Sarah, this was Sarah's lifetime. She lived 127 years. She died in Kiryat Arba, now Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham proceeded to mourn for her and bewail her. So, this close juxtaposition of life and death is what I'd like to reflect on together this morning. Because the Midrashim that expand our understanding of the death of Sarah, focus in some ways on that hair's breadth difference between life and death. It's between life and death, it's just a breath away, whether you're coming into life or leaving life. And this parsha in particular reflects through the Midrashim and a commentary of Aviva Zornberg that highlights this, that kind of dizzying, confusing, distressing randomness of those near misses, that someone could have been alive, but they died. Someone could have died, but they were alive. And so we see how our meditation practice, our religious practice, particularly in the Buddhist Zen practice, where each sit begins with contemplation on aging, sickness, and death, how all of these practices, in some way, create a space in which we can learn how to deal with this dizzying randomness of that hair's breadth between life and death. So, we learn of Sarah's death immediately after the moment when Abraham was about to sacrifice his son, Isaac, which we talked about last week. Abraham had picked up the knife to slay his sons when a messenger of God interrupted him, calling to him from heaven, "Abraham, Abraham." And Abraham answered, "Hineni, here I am." The angel says, "Do not raise your hand against the boy or do anything to harm him." Abraham looks up, sees a ram in the bushes, and sacrifices the ram instead of his son. The ordeal ends quickly with very few words, saying, "Abraham then returned to his servants, and they departed together for Beersheba, and Abraham stayed in Beersheba." Then there's a brief listing of the children and grandchildren of his brother Nahor, including Rebekah, a note that hints at a brighter future for Abraham's descendants, now that Isaac has survived the ordeal and can go on to bear more descendants for Abraham, in addition to the ones that his half brother will bear. And immediately after this, we learn that Sarah has died. So this juxtaposition, needless to say, have given rise to many midrashim and commentaries to explain why we hear of Sarah's death immediately after the near sacrifice of Isaac. In one version, Satan visits Sarah and tells her the story of Abraham taking Isaac up to be sacrificed, and Sarah dies before hearing the end of the story, believing her son is dead. However, several other midrashim make it clear that there's a way of understanding this in which Sarah knew Isaac survived, but she died nevertheless. And of these midrashim, there are different interpretations because it's such a difficult story to understand. One, for example, was that Sarah was so shocked and aggrieved that Abraham could have been set on sacrificing her son that she died right then and there on hearing it. And the words, "her soul flew from her body," give us a very graphic image of how she died from this shock. Another interpretation that Aviva Zornberg focuses on in a talk she gave in her weekly Torah class in 2018, and we can all hear this on YouTube in the Beit Avichai series. Zornberg explains that Sarah dies from the unbearable recognition that all that stood between her son's life and death was this hair's breadth, this moment in which Abraham heard the messenger's voice and interrupted the movement of his arm to sacrifice his son. A near miss. He could have gone through with the sacrifice, a tragedy that could have happened. And by a hair's breadth, it did not. And this difference between life and death seems all too random, all too precarious for her to bear. None of this, of course, is said in the actual Torah reading. This is what is said in the Midrash and the commentaries on the Midrash. In fact, it's meaningful that none of this is said in Torah because there are no words to describe so much of this story. For example, Abraham's soul searching. What about some inner conflict he must have had about sacrificing his son? He asks a little bit, which son? And, but Abraham, who is famously celebrated for his boldness in negotiating with God about saving the innocent people in Sodom, this same man did not have a word to say in negotiation or arguing with God's command to sacrifice his son. It kind of makes no sense. How could he have been so silent? Sarah's death is described with no words about her response to the horrifying news, and Midrash fills in the silence with stories that point in the direction of an answer, but they really don't give any truly satisfying words of explanation. Rather, all of the stories and commentaries point in the direction of what Aviva Zornberg calls a place beyond words. That place where we experience and deal with the unbearable randomness and uncertainty of life. So, whether you are religiously observant, or a psychotherapist, or a cognitive neuroscientist, or a meditator, or anyone with the capacity for emotional self-awareness and self-reflection. There's probably some way you can relate to the experience or the evidence for a place beyond words. While we have many words to describe subtle variations of emotional response, contentment, happiness, joy, ecstasy on the one hand, all variations, disappointment, sadness, loss, tragedy, overwhelming grief on the other end, none of these words truly capture the depth and breadth of the actual experience. In the end, the only thing that can contain these feelings is silence. In Jewish scripture, this silence appears in all the missing parts of these stories. What is not said can be more important than what is said. And we see this so clearly in the story of the sacrifice of Isaac, and the holes in the story between that and Sarah's death that follows. That empty space, the invitation for all these midrashim, is a gateway into that place beyond words, where we are invited to experience whatever is in our own heart in that moment. In response to the written story, what can't be captured in words. In Jewish practice, silence plays an important role. At a Shiva minyan, we are told not to approach the bereaved with our words unless the bereaved reaches out to us first. The need of the bereaved for silence, for experiencing and processing the loss in that place beyond words, is protected by this Shiva practice. In the face of grief, it can be very important to just sit in the presence of an attentive friend sharing the silent experience of grief that cannot possibly be contained in words. And I'm reminded that in a book that I refer to often, The Five Invitations, written by Frank Ostasevsky, about how understanding dying can help us to live our lives more fully. He recalls how he was so afraid the night before he had to have a major cardiac surgery as a result of a very unexpected heart attack, and how one of his meditator friends just came and sat with him. And he said, "I'm afraid." And she said, "I know." And she said very little else other than just sitting with him and being present. For those of us who participate in psychotherapy from either side of the relationship, we know that the therapist is attentive to what is said and to what is not said, what is left out. The most important and most unbearable aspects of our psychological life may be impossible to put into words. Sarah dies, it seems, from the unbearable recognition of the uncertainty, the apparent randomness of the difference between life and death. We all may have moments that we can recall of near misses, or of tragic loss. While many of us fear death, I expect that as we age, as we see our friends and family members age, get sick and die, we come to accept that we all will die. And if we could be reassured of a quiet, painless death in our late years of waning energy, surrounded by loved ones, we'd probably feel accepting of that. Death itself is not as scary as the randomness, the uncertainty, the senselessness of death coming or not coming to someone like Isaac, someone on the verge of setting out in life, The uncertainty of who will live and who will die is so momentous that we devote a whole series of holiday observations to it each year during the high holidays. The Unetanetokef in particular is a poem that's part of the liturgy. Who will live and who will die? How will they die? In the Zen tradition, each sit begins with a service in which we chant, I know I am of the nature to grow old, I know I am of the nature to get sick, I know I am of the nature to die. Embracing the rising and passing of all things as the heart of the practice. Pema Chodron, who teaches in the Tibetan tradition, takes us directly on this path in her book called Comfortable with Uncertainty. She describes the journey of the Bodhisattva. This is the awakened being who's capable of reaching nirvana, getting off the wheel of life, but postpones this out of compassion to stay here with us and save others who are suffering. The path of the Bodhisattva is not to transcend suffering, but to move toward turbulence and doubt, however we can. She writes, we explore the reality and unpredictability of insecurity and pain, and we try not to push it away. We let it be right down here in the thick of things, not high up on the mountain. We discover the love that will not die. It is open and spacious. While the story of Sarah's death highlights the near miss, the thin thread that separates life from death, the second half of the Torah reading highlights another chance miracle, the random event that makes new life, birth, and rebirth possible. In the aftermath of Sarah's death, Abraham sends his servant to find Isaac a wife, to go to the land of my birth and get a wife for my son Isaac. And the servant arrives in the city where Abraham's brother lives, and prays, here I stand by the spring as the daughters of the townspeople come out to draw water. Let the maiden to whom I say, please lower your jar that I may drink, and who replies, drink, and I will also water your camels. Let her be the one whom you have decreed for your servant Isaac. And so it happens that a beautiful young woman appears, offers the servant water from her jar, and then offers to draw all the water for his camels. Not only does this miracle happen, but Rebecca's father agrees to allow his daughter to marry Isaac. And when given the choice of waiting or going immediately with the service, Rebecca agrees to go, fulfilling Abraham's command that the servant return with the bride so that Abraham wouldn't have to let his son go and risk losing him at this painful time. Not only does the miracle happen, but Rebecca arrives to find Isaac out walking in the field and literally falls for him, it seems, getting down from her camel to be taken into the tent of his mother, Sarah, where Isaac took her as his wife. Isaac loved her and found comfort after her mother's death. According to the Midrash, the light that was extinguished in the tent upon Sarah's death returned the entrance of Rebecca into the tent. Thus, the near miss of Isaac's sacrifice, which seemed to have killed his mother, is followed by a miraculous moment of good fortune that also might not have happened except for the random circumstances that brought the servant and Rebecca together. So how do we understand the unfolding of reality with so much pivoting on these random events? Isaac could be dead, but for Abraham looking up and seeing the ram, there could have been no next generation had Rebecca not appeared at the right moment at the well. Well, we could say that this story reflects God's intentional manipulation of events that predictably lead to the outcome that God has designed all along. This interpretation suggests that we're all in good hands, directed by a beneficent or sometimes cruel authoritarian. But I don't think we believe that. that it's all laid out in a plan. But we could also say that these stories reflect what we actually feel and perceive with the unfolding of reality, which is a series of near misses and fortuitous coincidences. Living in a world of such uncertainty can lead us to all these habits like superstitious predictions and compulsions, or checking our phone for the weather all the time in order to have a feeling that we can predict and control the outcome. However, it's in that place beyond words, the space of silence, of prayer, of open awareness. It's there that we can rest in uncertainty, rest in the awareness of reality unfolding in totally unpredictable ways, the reality in which so much is beyond our control. And so we turn to our practice, to our relationship with something greater than ourselves, to rest in that uncertainty.